Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Pavi Mehta, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Today, our special guest speaker is the acclaimed writer, professor, and scholar-practitioner, Roger Walsh. In a few minutes, our moderator, Arye Cooper-Smith, will engage in a dialogue with our speaker. Over to you now, Arye, to introduce our guest and set this dialogue in motion.
Thank you so much, Pavi, for that generous introduction. Really excited today to be able to introduce and start the conversation with Dr. Roger Walsh. He is a professor of psychiatry, philosophy, and anthropology, as well as a professor of the Religious Studies program at the University of California in Irvine. He's a celebrated writer and one of the world's leading researchers of meditation, altered states of consciousness, and the field of transpersonal psychology. Roger graduated from Australia's Queensland University with degrees in psychology, physiology, neuroscience, and medicine. How's that for a list of degrees? And then he came to the U.S. as a Fulbright scholar and trained at Stanford, where he passed licensing exams here in medicine, psychology, and psychiatry. For over 30 years, Roger's been researching how to enhance well-being, physical, psychological, social, and spiritual. This search has been powered by questions such as, what does it mean to live wisely and well, and what does it take? How can we cultivate qualities such as love and wisdom, kindness and compassion? What is meant by terms such as enlightenment and liberation, salvation, satori? Roger says, I've explored these questions professionally in my roles as a professor, physician, and therapist, and personally as a spouse, spiritual practitioner, and inquisitive human being. Obviously, I have no final answers, he says. Roger's research and writings span several areas, including the nature of psychological health and well-being, meditation and contemplative practices, religion and spirituality, wisdom and other virtues, integral studies, and the psychological roots of our current global crisis. He's deeply immersed personally in contemplative practices as a student, researcher, and teacher. He has numerous books and publications. Some of them include Paths Beyond Ego, Meditation, Classical and Contemporary Perspectives, Essential Spirituality with a foreword by the Dalai Lama, and The World of Shamanism. He's currently editing The World's Great Wisdom, What Sages Say About Living Wisely and Well. And he is also currently working on a new PBS documentary called 8 Ways to Well-Being, which offers scientifically backed tools for leading healthier, more joyful lives. And in his other lives, Roger was formerly a circus acrobat, as well as a record holder in high diving and trampolining. And recently, he graduated from the San Francisco Comedy College and tried his hand, he says rather unsuccessfully, at stand-up comedy. He's married to psychologist Frances Vaughn, and together they've co-authored several books. Roger, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much indeed for the opportunity of being with ServiceSpace. I've admired the work of Pavi and the community for a long time, and so it's a delight to be with you.
You know, we were speaking earlier this week, and you spoke about offering a dedication for this call. So I'd like to ask you if you would, for all of us, offer that dedication.
I'd be delighted. I think one of the key things that becomes so apparent from looking at both psychology and contemplative practice is that intention is so key. And so I like to take as a practice, and of course this isn't just my idea, take as a practice before beginning any undertaking, looking at the asking the question, what is this for? And the more deeply we reflect on that, particularly for people such as a part of this community, very service-oriented, then it at bottom turns out to be, you know, what will serve the welfare and awakening of all. So I would love to have us all just take a moment and allow us to feel into our deepest need, our deepest want, and to recognize that one aspect of that is the desire that what we're doing now will serve the welfare and awakening of all, and to set that as our intention and aspiration for our time together.
Ah, that's beautiful. I feel myself calming down, right? Or calming up. Thank you so much. So with that intention for all of us, I want to ask you a couple questions. I want to start off, you know, we've titled this call From Altered States to Altered Traits. And on this page, we have a quote from you. It says, contemplative practices aim not merely to induce altered states, but to induce altered traits, or as Houston Smith so eloquently put it, to transform flashes of illumination into abiding light. Can you unpack that for us and say a little bit more about what you mean?
Sure. I assume practically all people in this community have some sort of spiritual orientation and some sort of inner work practice. And one of the delights and pleasures of any contemplative practice is that if we do it long enough, we get these various kinds of peak experiences, very waves perhaps, or openings to beautiful and benevolent emotions such as love and compassion, or simply joy, even becoming ecstasy. We also tap into our deeper motives and aspirations, the motive to actualize our capacities to become and realize more of what we can be, the motive towards self-transcendence, to grow towards that larger self that we most truly are, and the pull towards service, and that kind of recognition that service is not, as our culture assumes, self-sacrifice, but rather enlightened self-interest. So as we do contemplative practices, we have these peak experiences, these flashes, these moments, these some of which can last for hours or so forth, and these are variously known as peak experiences or altered states. And they're wonderful and a blessing, and they're not the final goal. The hope is that if we immerse ourselves in these kind of experiences, recognitions, pulls, that they will become part of our personality, that epiphanies will transform into personality, that altered states will become altered traits, that peak experiences will become more enduring plateau experiences. And as you quoted the wonderful religious scholar Houston Smith, that we will be able to transform flashes of illumination into abiding light, which we can then share with others. So the goal is to have these wonderful recognitions become part of our basic personality.
So how does that actually work? If I engage in a meditation or some type of practice, and I get into that altered state and I feel a shift in my consciousness, then what is it that takes me from the altered state to the altered trait? How does that work, actually?
Well, there are many different processes involved, but maybe we can keep it on, we can go into psychological processes, but maybe if we keep it on a very practical level, of when we are graced with a peak experience, intense wave of joy or compassion and caring or love, how can we facilitate that becoming a more enduring way of being for us? And there are several things. One is to stop and simply appreciate it, to immerse ourselves in the experience, to really give ourselves time to rest in that feeling of joy. Another is, or the feeling of love, or the pull of compassion and generosity and service. So one is to simply to take time with it, to honor the experience, not to rush on to the next one or rush into just simply spinning out on it. Another thing is to explore it. What does it really feel like to have a wave of compassion arise, to have real care and concern for others, filling our being, and to the extent we explore this, how it feels in our body, what thoughts and images arise, what aspirations, what hopes, to that extent we kind of fill out the experience and transform it from simply an emotional state to an insight, a deeper understanding of both the experience and its implications. And then we can subsequently do things such as journal about it, perhaps talk with some wise friends, as ways of further understanding and embodying this as part of our being.
So what you're saying is really to sort of take the time and pay attention in various ways and sort of give that experience a larger presence in our lives.
Yes, and in some ways this is an antidote to our contemporary lifestyles, which are so busy, frenetic, and those of us who are graced with fortunate lives may have a number of very positive experiences, and it's very easy to just want to get used to going from one to another, and, oh yeah, that was a nice experience, on to the next. But there are certain experiences that really deserve to be honored and mined for their depth, for their wisdom, for their insights, for their implications for us and for our lives.
Mm. Now I want to ask your view of this. I've heard some people say that these experiences come as a result of practice, and that as I practice I can get better at bringing forth these altered states. And I've heard other people say that they come as a gift of grace.
And I don't see a conflict between those. Every gift is a grace in a way, and we can set the odds in their favor and our favor. There's a saying in both Hinduism and Islam that the winds of grace are always blowing, but you have to raise your sail. And humorously, there's a saying that enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. So, yes, it's a very skillful attitude to practice the recognition that all the gifts in our lives are in some ways grace. They don't come to us purely by our own creation. There's a much larger field of creation and possibilities that are operating than our little egos can ever control. And we can also tip the scales.
When you and I spoke earlier this week, you were speaking about how spiritual practice relates to the social and planetary crisis of our time. And to my mind, this relates to our saying in Service Space when we say, change yourself, change the world. So the relationship, on the one hand, we're living at a time of social and planetary crisis, and on the other hand, we're talking about these spiritual practices. Can you say more about this relationship from your own perspective?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of ways in here, and let's perhaps start with looking at the sources of these enormous social and global crises we're facing at this time, and then perhaps look at some of the attitudes towards practice and service. First off, if we step back and look at our contemporary world, we see that for the first time in human history, each and every one of the major threats we're facing is human caused.
I'm sorry, each and every one of the major threats we face in history is what?
Human-caused.
Uh-huh, yes.
So whether you look at overpopulation, pollution, ecological degradation, weapons of mass destruction, etc., they're all human-caused. So we're in a new phase in human history, and what that suggests is that in addition to the military and political and economic forces that are creating these enormous problems, that at some level they are an expression of our individual and collective minds, and that what we call our global problems are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective psychopathologies and spiritual pathologies. They reflect the tensions within us, the conflicts within us, and the conflicts between us. And what that suggests is that if we're going to truly heal these great issues, it's going to require both outer and inner work. It's going to require, yes, feeding the hungry, and yes, working to reduce weapons of mass destruction and protect the environment. And it's going to require economic and political interventions. But at a deeper level, it's also going to require that we investigate, unearth, recognize, and heal the psychological and spiritual dis-ease within us and between us, which created these problems in the first place. So clearly, we need, even more so than we have in the past, a combination of both skillful outer work in whatever field is our particular field of expertise or interest, plus inner work to ensure that we can use each action, each enterprise, each project in a way which not only addresses the outer issues, but also allows us to see more deeply into them, to be with other people in more skillful, compassionate ways, and to alleviate, to at least to some extent, the psychological and spiritual roots that underlie these. And so that gets us into the question, of course, of, well, what kind of practice does that? What kind of work combines intervention in the outer world, trying to do it as skillfully and effectively as we possibly can, and transformation of our inner world? And of course, there is a millennia-old tradition of that. It's best known as Karma Yoga from the yogic or Hindu tradition. And Karma Yoga is the yoga of work and action in the world, in which one uses one's activity, one's service, one's work, as the the focus and environment for one's spiritual practice. And we can go, maybe we'll go into more detail on that in a moment, but when one takes that attitude that one's spiritual practice is one's work in the world and that they complement and reinforce each other, then we go into ourselves in order to go more effectively out into the world, and we go out into the world in order to go more deeply into ourselves, and we keep that cycle of inner and outer work continuing as long as we think that inner and outer are different. And interesting enough, this is Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, in his survey of world history, found that the common characteristic of people who he felt had had most beneficial impact on human history was what he called the cycle of withdrawal and return, that so many of these people had at some stage in their life withdrawn from the social rat race, shall we call it, to go inward, to plumb the depths of their own being, to come to some sort of realization and insight, and then return to the world to offer their insights and healing capacities in whatever way was they thought appropriate. So that's a kind of big picture overview response to the question.
Ah, and you had said that there's more details you could get into. What did you mean by that? Are you talking about specific examples of people, or, you know, if you're going to take it a little further, where do you go next?
Well, one could go in a number of directions. One could continue looking at the big picture, or we could get into the kind of nitty-gritty of how one does this practice, and I suspect that might be a good avenue for this community, which is so dedicated to service.
Yeah, I like the idea of the nitty-gritty. If you would like to say a few things about that, about, you know, the karma yoga practice that you're talking about.
Sure. Let's see. Well, let me give a little context first, and then get into some of the actual details of practice. The yogic traditions of India have four main kinds of yoga. There's the yoga of bhakti, which is love. The primary focus is on cultivating love and kindness towards others. The second practice is jnana yoga, which is the path of insight and wisdom. Then there's the yoga of meditation, contemplation. And finally, there's karma yoga, which is for those of us, probably all of us listening, who are householders, who are working in the world, who aren't going to be spending our lives in retreat or able to devote large amounts of time to these practices. And for karma yoga is the yoga in which one uses one's work and action in the world as the focus and context of one's spiritual practice. So one takes whatever one's doing and transforms it into practice. Let me give first just the core essentials of the practice, and then we can fill it out. So traditionally in karma yoga, and of course one finds elements of this in all the world's great religious traditions, but it's most systematically laid out in the karma yoga tradition of Hinduism. So in the classic text on this is called the Bhagavad Gita, which is sometimes not so well called, but it is called the Hindu Bible. It's a beautiful, quite small text. And the essence of the practice is threefold. One, that in undertaking any major work or activity in the world, one first offers it. Traditionally, one offers it to God, but one can also offer it to any transpersonal goal or aspiration, as long as it's something bigger than your little ego. The second part is one does one's work in the world as fully and impeccably and wholeheartedly as you can. And the third, and here's the knife edge that makes this such such a superb spiritual practice is while working towards an aspirational goal of service, of contribution, of doing one's work, and while doing it as impeccably as one can, one simultaneously releases attachment to how it turns out.
Mm.
And that's the knife edge which makes it such a powerful practice, because, of course, usually when we're doing something that we're really involved in, and particularly when we're doing it for an idealistic goal such as service or contribution or something like world peace, or feeding the hungry, we are definitely attached to things working out the way we think they should. And, of course, that's totally understandable, but attachment is very different from aspiration. We can aspire to doing good in the world, but as soon as we get attached to the outcome, then there's going to be suffering. Then we're going to contract. We're going to get fearful if we think our work won't work. We're going to get angry if people are getting our way. We're going to get depressed if things turn south, etc. So those are the three core elements of the practice, and maybe in a moment we can expand those out, but perhaps, Aria, you have something you'd like to add.
Well, I don't know if I have something I'd like to add, but, you know, I'm curious, Roger, if you could say at this point, if we can talk a little bit about your own spiritual journey. What you were doing in Australia, you were an acrobat, you were a diver. How did you first sort of discover and set forth on your own spiritual journey? Can you tell us a little bit about that, about your story?
Sure. I had the very good fortune of, as you mentioned, coming over here from Australia on a Fulbright scholarship, and I arrived at Stanford to do my psychiatry training, having finished medical school in Australia, and I immediately went into culture shock, going from Australia, which was a somewhat conservative, anti-intellectual, sexist community, to California in the 70s was quite a transition.
I bet.
I was doing my psychiatry training and doing psychotherapy on people, and we're not quite sure what I was doing. And I figured I had a moral obligation to try some myself, so I figured I'd go into therapy for a few weeks, and had the extreme good fortune of going into therapy with a wonderfully wise man by the name of Jim Bugenthal, who wrote a number of books on therapy. And I thought I was going in for an interesting little few weeks, and 2 years later I staggered out. My entire life turned around and upside down, and having been opened to the inner world, which I didn't even know exists, and finding that there was inner universe as vast and mysterious as the outer, which I'd been totally unaware of, and that I really felt like I'd lived my entire life on the top 6 inches of a wave on top of an ocean that I hadn't even known was there. And to find that there was an inner universe, to find that there were depths of insight and feeling and information and wisdom within us all that I and 99% of the culture had been unaware of was just mind-boggling to me. So from there, I began exploring the many isms that California has. California was a great place to continue this exploration, and I dove into all sorts of things. And to my great surprise, found myself, you know, beginning to do things like chanting and meditation. I couldn't figure out why the hell I was doing these things, because at that stage, I thought religion was the opiate of the masses. And I really puzzled over it, because these practices seemed to help. And there was literally one moment as I was walking across the living room floor when I realized that at the contemplative heart, the great religions have a set of practices for cultivating the qualities of heart and mind, the insights, the virtues, the capacities that the great founders had realized, and that that hidden behind the conventional institutional structures, which were primarily around ritual and service, valuable as those are, but there were deeper depths to these religious traditions. There were contemplative depths, which were effectively roadmaps for transforming and maturing ourselves so as to develop the very capacities that the great sages and saints of history had realized. And that was, that just blew me out of the water. It's better known now, but at that time there were very few people who had kind of come to that realization. So for me, it was a complete game changer.
So what you're saying is that you began to be aware that the various traditions and religions underneath the cultural differences of the surfaces had some underlying essence where they were the same. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that the world's great traditions, each of them had behind the conventional institutional structures a deeper dimension, which was not well known in the Western culture, and that these traditions share a variety of practices and a variety of aspirations and goals. It's not to say, of course, they're the same by any means, but there is great overlap in the contemplative practices and depths and aspirations of the great traditions, and that these practices are now available to us all. 50 years ago, meditation was some esoteric thing that widows did, and yoga was virtually unknown, and so forth. But now, not only do we have an influx of powerful practices from the East, we also have the revival of our own contemplative practices from the West, whether it's the Jewish Kabbalah and Hasidic practices, or Christian contemplations, or Islamic Zikr. These practices are now resurfacing and becoming their power and legitimacy is being recognized. So for the first time in history, we have a variety of practices for cultivating the very qualities, the beautiful qualities of law, emotions such as love and compassion, aspirations of service and altruism, etc., that are most satisfying and rewarding to us as individuals and that are most needed for our social and planetary survival.
Was it this discovery that turned into your book Essential Spirituality?
Yes, in large part. The book Essential Spirituality, it's subtitled The Seven Central Practices to Awaken Heart and Mind, was my attempt to unearth the shared practices across the world's traditions. The question that I kept puzzling over during the 20 years of practice before I wrote that book was, okay, we have these contemplative practices from all over the world. What do they share in common? And what are the wisest people who've ever lived? What do they recommend we do with our lives? What capacities of heart and mind do they recommend we cultivate, and how do they suggest we do it? So I was just interested in what, the best, the brightest of human beings, the wisest sages, the greatest saints, really said were most important for living a full and satisfying and contributory and awakening life. And how do they suggest we do that? And what became apparent over the 3 years it took me to write the book and the many years of research before that was that it seemed like there were seven core qualities of heart and mind that these people recommended. They all seemed to agree that ethics was really important, that if we want to live fully, if we want to awaken, if we want to be able to serve and contribute, we need to live ethical lives in which we seek the welfare of all people. They advocated emotional transformation, the reduction of destructive emotions like anger and fear, and the cultivation of positive emotions such as love and compassion and joy. They all recommended that we cultivate attention because, as we all know, the mind wanders all over the place. It's really, our minds have a mind of their own. And particularly in our frenetic, data-driven culture, our minds are even more frenetic and scattered than usual. And yet the power of the mind is a function of how effectively we can bring attention to whatever is most important. So cultivating attention or concentration, refining perception, being able to see deeply into ourselves and into others and notice the nuances of life and emotion, and which enables us to know what's going on more effectively. And then there's the practice of wisdom, of insight and understanding. And finally, there's the practice of, in fact, all these practices lead to and culminate in service, in contributing to others. And that is service both as a goal of our spiritual practice and as a means of spiritual practice. Again, the kind of karma yoga, the idea that service to others is both a gift to others but also a gift to ourselves, can be intensely transformative of ourselves, can cultivate qualities such as generosity and care and compassion, and can inhibit problematic emotions and motives like greed and fear and jealousy. So it seemed that there was a remarkable agreement across traditions, across ages and saints, that these qualities of heart and mind were really important. And there's one other thing that really stood out, and that is that the thing that surprised me most in the 3 years of writing Essential Spirituality, the Seven Central Practices, was that for every one of the qualities of heart and mind that these sages recommended cultivating, they all said, if you want to develop this quality, whether it's ethical living or generosity and service or love and compassion or concentration and calm, if whatever one of these qualities you want to cultivate, hang out with people who have it. That is, seek out and spend time with the people who embody these qualities, because consciousness is catchy. We become like those we're around. Parents know that. They try to be very careful who their kids hang out. But it works on us as adults, too. And that was the thing which surprised me most, just how much they all emphasized the importance of like-minded community, a community aspiring to these kinds of ideals of service and love and compassion and ethics, etc. That was the big surprise.
Wow. So the importance of community, the importance of the sangha, the importance of developing these qualities in community.
Yes, and of course the being in community may be a fluid thing. We talked before of Arnold Toynbee's discovery of the cycle of withdrawal and return. So perhaps the ideal will be for us to find communities of like-minded and like-hearted and like-souled people, and to, when we're in the world, definitely spend time with them, but to also take time for withdrawing, to have periods of quiet and calm and reflection and solitude, Perhaps it'll be a part of each day. Perhaps it'll be part of one day each week. Perhaps it'll be a week each year, you know, as much time as we can afford and are drawn to. But it's very important that that combination of alone time to go deeply within and community time to share and connect, both are truly very important.
Yeah, I'm saying, amen, I hear you. You know, I'm thinking that when you sort of started, when you came to California in the 70s and started discovering some of this stuff, at that time there was a lot going on around individual practices, you know, weekend workshops and classes and all kinds of things about developing spirituality and meditation and yoga and so on. And there was a phrase that I think started in the 70s of spiritual materialism, right? And it became kind of a consumer thing that if I could spend money, I could go to a weekend at Esalen and have a wonderful experience and then come home and practice it. And then more recently, there are, you know, there are people who go into corporations and train people in mindfulness practices in the corporate world. And I'm wondering, from your viewpoint, how much of that has value? At what point is it spiritual materialism, or at what point is it valuable, and how do you tell where that boundary is?
Yeah, that's one of the questions of our time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, let's acknowledge first off that one of the core elements to look at is motivation, and maybe you can keep it personal for a moment. You know, what's our motivation in doing something? Now, we also, so that's a first consideration. Why am I doing this? And that's a great motto. Start with why before undertaking any project. Look at why am I doing this? What's the motivation? What's it actually, and what's it really for? What can it best serve? So that's one starting point. The other thing we need to recognize is motivation is usually always mixed. So I may, you know, undertake a project for, you know, maybe I'm writing my next book, and I certainly hope it'll contribute and get some valuable ideas out into the world. But being who I am and being only half cooked, there's probably going to be lots of motivation. Gee, I hope it really gets out there and I get some recognition and all that. So in very practical terms, we look at motivation, we recognize our humanity, and we try to do what we do from the most service space oriented way possible, recognizing that we're human. There'll be other contaminating motives in there, but we can try not to feed and fuel them. We can try to make what we knew not primarily about our egocentric motivation, not about, as using the term you came up with, REA, not spiritual materialism. That is, not using our spiritual work in the service of our ego, rather using our spiritual work to transcend our egocentric motivation. Well, that's one thing. Now, a bigger general question, as we look out of the cultural scene and see different practices permeating into the mainstream and being co-opted by it, and the question you're asking, well, is this good? How do we know if it's good? And you know, first off, we need to acknowledge we don't really have any data on this yet.
Uh-huh. So
I have no doubt that being mindful will allow you to be a better salesman or a more effective soldier, to shoot straighter, etc. The question is, what else will it do? And I suspect, you know, the rea- reality is these things are going to be used for that. The interesting question is, will they shift the motives of people who undertake the practice, which to the point that they begin to look more deeply at what they're doing and why they're doing it, and whether it's really worth, they want their lives to be about that. My hope is it will have those effects as well. And I think probably the reality is it'll help people be more effective at what they're doing, and for at least some people it will call them to question what they're doing. How much? I don't know. I don't think any of us know at this stage. But I think it's one of the things to look at, and hopefully there'll be people researching that.
Interesting. Yeah, as you're speaking, Roger, I'm thinking, aha, a subversive purpose. There might be the overt purpose of helping people be better workers and helping the company do a better job, whatever. But then there might be a subversive effect, whereas people start questioning, who am I, what am I doing, why am I doing it, and how do I lead a better life?
Yeah, I think that's very well summarized, Aria. I think you've exactly got it. And I think that some of these practices, mindfulness, yoga, et cetera, which are being done for, stress management or blood pressure, clearly we know from case histories, if not from large-scale studies, we know from individual case histories that certain people get a lot more than they bargained for.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I think you summarized it well.
Roger, you've been involved in so many different kinds of research projects in this area about consciousness and spirituality and so on. I'm curious about today, of all the various fields and projects that you've been involved with, what has the most energy and the most excitement for you right now?
Well, let's see. At the moment, I'm feeling very pulled towards the exploring, researching, and particularly writing about the cultivation of what have traditionally been called virtues, qualities such as love, compassion, altruism, and wisdom. And I'm interested for a number of reasons. One, it's just a personal pull, but more from a larger perspective. In the West, we've thought of virtues or qualities such as love as something that just happens to you. We have a Hollywood version of love, that love's something that happens to you. If the right person says the right thing to you and looks the right way, at you, then you feel love, and it kind of descends on you like an attack of epilepsy. But that's a very immature or partial perspective on love. That's a kind of romantic love, and we all, not to say anything against romantic love, but there's no appreciation in our culture that love is one of the great arts of human existence, and there are practices we can adopt which will strengthen and deepen and expand and make stronger and more resilient a kind of love, the agape of Christianity, the metta of Buddhism, the ren of Confucianism, bhakti, etc., which are all-encompassing, which embrace everyone, even all life, in an unconditional care that just wishes the welfare of all beings, and that is truly ecstatic. And for me, just to give a very quick personal example, when I began doing the practices for cultivating love and kindness and compassion, etc., that are part of Buddhist, Hindu practices, it was the most ecstatic month of my life. I was living in a little cell so small I could reach out and touch the walls, and literally just developing feelings of love for everyone. I was in ecstasy for a month.
And wow.
We just underestimate the we have, our culture has totally underestimated the potentials and power and joy of developing and practicing virtues such as this. So I'm particularly drawn to exploring, researching, and writing about these and bringing our culture to helping, at least to contribute to our culture, having a deeper appreciation of our possibilities as human beings, our possibilities for developing these qualities, and for pointing to some of the practices that the great wisdom and religious traditions have made available to us over centuries for doing just this.
Love as a virtue. Well, I to me that sounds like a great example of from altered state. I think most of us tend to think of love as an altered state, and you're really talking about love as an altered trait.
Yeah, and of course there are different, yes, and there are practices for that kind of transformation of love in from state to trait. My wife and I did a book, Accept This Gift and Gifts from A Course in Miracles, just drawing out some of the quotes on love and kindness and joy from the Course in Miracles, which is a very weirdly titled but very profound Christian contemplative text. And so we just pulled those out, and just to read those is, you know, evokes those kind of recognitions and qualities. So one can begin by simply turning to some of these ideas and these texts and these practices, and just allow soaking oneself in them, and they have their impact.
Mm.
And if anyone's interested, again, Essential Spirituality has a whole section on emotional transformation and the cultivation of love, in which I pulled together different practices from around the world just for that. So you know, these things are becoming available, but there's a lot more work to do to have our culture realize what we're capable of and what we can practice and develop.
I want to point out to everyone that just looking at the time, we're getting close to the top of the hour, and then Pavi will be taking it from there with any questions that that you may have. If you're listening, if you're on the phone, you can dial *6, and if you're listening online, you can send us an email at ask@servicespace.org. So this idea of the virtues is really interesting. I mean, this is really a very old idea, right, going back to the Greeks and Christianity, and I think in all the spiritual traditions. How did you come there to the idea of the virtues? And another virtue or two, you've talked about love. What are one or two other virtues that have really sort of shown up for you as being particularly important right now?
Well, there's a long list of virtues, of course.
Yeah.
You pointed out, Ari, back to the ancient Greeks, in each of the world's spiritual traditions, one finds lists of key virtues, and each tradition kind of may focus on one. Christianity on love and forgiveness, Confucianism on Ren, kind of all-embracing compassion, etc. Let's see, just to mention a couple of others. Well, let's acknowledge that joy is one of the virtues. To the extent we're joyous, we are more likely to be ethical, kind, altruistic, and the more we're likely to evoke joy in others. Compassion, of course, is a key one, and we tend to think of compassion, mistake it for a kind of pity, but pure compassion is just this loving care that others be free of pain. And of course, wisdom, intellectual virtue or insight virtue, and that's actually one I've been writing on. I did a book, edited a book modestly titled The World's Great Wisdom, looking at what each of the great traditions says about what wisdom is and how to cultivate it. So So that's something I hope to go into further. And even if you look, and you also find even back thousands of years ago, you find in the ancient tradition, the most ancient of all traditions, shamanism. You find that the capacities and the virtues of service to the community is a core quality. So you know, these are, as you suggested, very widespread. There's a wide range of them, and practically any motive or emotion which is benevolent is probably a virtue of some kind.
I'm just thinking that, you know, in my education, my public education, most people I know, we don't talk about these. We didn't talk about these things. I'm just trying to imagine if the cultivation of these virtues were part of the education of every child, what a difference that might make.
Oh, I think you've just touched on something enormously important, Ari. Most of our Western educational system is about making a living and not about making a life.
Hey.
You know, and that needs to change. It's beginning in some ways, but it really needs to change.
Yeah. Thank you. So, Pavi, are you ready to take it from here?
I am. Thank you so much. This has been a fascinating beginning to this conversation, and we actually do have a caller in the queue who I'm going to queue up.
Part of the challenge to us in the very large picture is how we project our own shadow onto whole groups of people, I will say in quotes, out there, like Boko Haram or Islamic State. And it's so hard for us as individuals and as collectives to see people as humans and realize that everybody has a story and a reason, and there is a human being out there. How do we help one another where we live to get into the condition where we are willing to explore our own shadow and see the other and entertain the other as human and not go out to obliterate them?
Oh my, that's a very beautiful question, one of the great truly important questions of our time, particularly in the midst of our current divisive social and political scene. I think that's a question that is important, as you imply, both at an individual level and a social level. Individually, we can talk in general and specific terms, and what I mean by that is if we're trying to cultivate a capacity such as, or to heal ourselves, or to develop a virtue, there are both general approaches and specific approaches. And by what I mean by that is there's a general principle that if we want to heal some aspect of ourselves, if we want to grow some part of ourselves, then we can focus on that particular quality, which is a specific approach, and we can do general psychological and spiritual practice, which will hopefully tend to mature us generally and in the process heal the specific issue. So you're talking about the tendency to dehumanize others and to project our own shadow onto them. So speaking most generally, any work for each of us as individuals right now, any work we do on ourselves psychologically, spiritually, will tend to heal the shadow some. You know, let's not underestimate the difficulty of healing our shadow, because shadow is that aspect of ourselves which we don't want to recognize. It's literally those aspects of ourselves which we have pushed out of awareness. And so it's just to recognize it is a big step. So now working specifically with shadow, a general first step is if there's anything in other people that we are strongly reactive to, that's a good cue. So if we're really angry or hateful or jealous of some group, person or group, then that's a good signal to look at ourselves and see, okay, what aspect of myself does this person represent that I'm unwilling to see in myself? So that's an initial step. Second, I think you mentioned some very important pieces of the puzzle, and that is you said that you gave voice to the fact that we do tend to demonize others, to dehumanize them, and that this is a defensive, immature, defensive way of being. And I think one key thing is to get that out into the world and to delegitimize the demonization of other people. At the moment, it's become politically and socially accepted to demonize other groups. And so I think anything we can do to speak about others, to relate about others in more human ways makes a contribution. But these are big, tough issues, very difficult. And thank you for bringing them up.
Help people tell their story.
Yes, yes, thank you, yes. Yes, and you implied there's something very important. To whatever extent we listen to other people, that in itself can be very healing of the relationship and of ourselves and for them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Roger, I had a question that I wanted to ask, and this kind of rewinds a little bit to just looking back at some of your early influences, and if you could talk a little bit about the teachers or the role models or exemplars you've held in your own life at different stages. That would be wonderful.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's see. Role models, exemplars. There have been ones I've had the good fortune to be with and work with, and then there have been people out there who I may not have known so well. Let's see. Well, a lifelong inspiration for me was Mother Teresa and her selfless devotion to service and contribution. And at one stage in the 80s, I actually went over to Calcutta to work with her.
Wow.
in her centers there, and was both touched and horrified. I was horrified by the amount of suffering in Calcutta at that time. It just blew me out of the water to be, you know, living in a hotel, and outside on the street in front of me were people living on the street, beggars, destitute, homeless, lepers, etc. And be face to face with that extent of suffering just kind of I found very difficult and hard to work with, because I had not yet developed the kind of combination of compassion and equanimity that is really essential for that kind of deep work. To be with Mother Teresa herself was very inspiring, of course, to see her and her nuns each day getting up and going and doing their prayers, and then heading out to their various centers and working long hours, and then going, withdrawing, and doing their prayers and contemplation. As Mother Teresa said, we're not just social workers. So it wasn't that they were spending the whole day in the, say, caring for the sick and dying. They'd spend part of the day, but then they'd also spend part of the day doing their inner work, their prayers, their their practices, their study, etc. So that combination was very powerful, very inspiring, and simply to be exposed to how so many people in the world live in destitution and poverty, which I, in my nice California existence, am very insulated from, was very impactful, very powerful. So that was a real gift. So she was a lifelong inspiration. Then there have been role models, teachers, inspirations for work more on the inner realms. And my own therapist, Jim Bugenthal, opened the inner universe to me, as I described. There have been a variety of meditation and contemplative practices, teachers. The first one was Ram Dass, the former Harvard psychologist who, with Tim Leary, got kicked out of Harvard for their psychedelic research. And Ram Dass became a very effective teacher of contemplative practices, and he was my first introduction to those. And then there were a variety of other meditation teachers or spiritual teachers from multiple traditions. Jack Kornfield in Buddhism. I could run through a list of people who have been important. You know, Father Thomas Keating in Christianity, the Course in Miracles material that I mentioned, funnily named, but very profound Christian contemplative practices, which my wife and I did together. And that's actually worth mentioning, because A Course in Miracles is a contemplative Christian practice, and it's the only one that my wife and I found anywhere which uses peer relationships as the primary context and focus of one's spiritual practice. Other traditions use teachers and gurus as, you know, part of the spiritual practice, but A Course in Miracles is very explicit in focusing attention on peer community and peer relationships and using that as one's practice. So that's been very important, and it was wonderful for me and my wife to do it together, because it's a beautiful practice to do in relationship, and we were actually moved enough to draw some of the quotes from the Course out in a number of books, Accept This Gift and Gifts from A Course in Miracles, because it was just very, very important to us. And so, you know, those are a taste. Yeah. Is that kind of what you were thinking of, Bobby?
That absolutely is. And actually, Gifts from A Course in Miracles was what I had picked that up after picking up A Course in Miracles. Oddly titled as it was, I think it had come up in enough conversations that I wanted to see what it was about. And then it kind of drew me in. And then finding your and Francis's book after that was a true gift, because it essentialized it in a way that... that just, I don't know, it just felt so potent. And I wondered, what was it that, I just wanted to know, what's the story behind those books that you worked on with your wife?
Well, let's see. Well, we were fortunate to we were both writers and psychologists, and it felt natural for us to, as we were doing our work, to do some books together. So we edited a number of books, Beyond Ego, The Transpersonal Vision, which is a collection of articles on the interface of psychology and spirituality. And we also edited some books from the Course, because we just loved that material so much. We were studying it intensively together. We were sharing it. And both of us, you know, developed our favorite, found our favorite quotes and excerpts, and thought, well, gee, wouldn't it be nice to share these with people? So we just basically had a wonderful time collecting our most favorite lines and putting them together and making them into little books that other people could get a taste of, which I think hopefully serve a couple of purposes, some for some people like yourself. They get into the Course and dive deeply into it, but then they find it's just nice to have some collected excerpts and quotations. And for other people who haven't got into the Course, but kind of, you know, the Course in Miracles is three big fat books, and it can look a little intimidating at first, but for other people, those books accept this gift. Gifts from A Course in Miracles serve as a kind of entry point, a fairly easy way of getting a taste of it and seeing as if this is something people would like to dive deeper into.
And just for those listeners who may not be familiar with the terrain of the Course of Miracles, how would you describe it?
The Course is a collection of three books. Content-wise, it's the perennial wisdom or the core of the great traditions expressed in a Christian language and metaphor, so it definitely has Christian overtones, though certainly not traditional ones. It's much more a contemplative, it's a much more a practice for doing in the world with a Christian flavor, but it's certainly not conventional. It's much more contemplative. The actual practice consists of a lesson for each day of the year, so there are 365 lessons, and it basically offers a particular thought to reflect on and work with and bring to your activities in life during the day. So the first lesson is nothing I see means anything, which is kind of funny, but it's the introduction to the recognition that we are the authors of our experience. We are the people who are responsible for our lives, who really have a major role in what we feel and how we feel. It undermines the victim role, etc. And it gradually builds a thought system, which is a much more loving, kindly, compassionate, and awakening thought system than our usual egoic one. And so it basically offers a more healing, loving, awakening way of thinking and looking at the world than our usual little ego does. And just as an example, my lesson today is light and joy and peace abide in me, which, you say that enough times during the day, you start to feel very nice.
You know, it reminds me of something you said in another interview. I thought that it was so powerful. I mean, to just kind of come across this and map it to my experience, my own inner experience, and where you say, in my understanding, systems of thought and belief are hierarchically ordered, and it is possible to unearth deeper and deeper presuppositions in such systems. The presuppositions can themselves become objects of awareness rather than filters of awareness. Contemplative practices are ways of bringing these presuppositions into awareness and transforming them from things we look through to things we look at. And this makes it possible for us to modify them.
Yeah. And that's so key, because our thought systems really, that's what we create our world with, our understanding of the world and the way we look at the world and make sense of it and shade it and color it. And if we can bring awareness to them, then we go from being victims of our unconscious thoughts and thought systems to being the creators of them. And that's certainly something that A Course in Miracles and, of course, other contemplative practices aim to do.
Yeah, it's so powerful when you get a kind of a glimpse or a taste of that. I have more questions, but I do want to go to, we have another caller in the queue. Wendy, can I call on you?
Hi, Randy.
Hi. Sitting right next to Aria here. and what an incredibly rich conversation. Thanks so much for that. When you were talking about the virtues of love, joy, compassion, wisdom, I mean, I'm ready to sign up right now, but I'm wondering what practices do you recommend for balance? Because, I mean, my cup can just completely run over and so I can get dry. So how do you how do you use these virtues in a way that's balanced?
Yeah, okay, great, good question. Couple of things. First off, let's just acknowledge the importance of the question. In our contemporary Western overloaded, super busy, sound bit, byte driven lives, balance is a core challenge for all of us. And so let's just acknowledge how important this is. So how do we do that? Well, first off, let's acknowledge the inner wisdom within all of us, that if we just take some time, some quiet time, each of us has the inner sensitivity, the wisdom to feel when we're out of balance. And if we go into that feeling, we will become aware of the ways in which we're drawn off balance. Maybe it's a feeling of tension, which if we go into, we'll realize we just feel overloaded. Maybe it's a feeling of dryness that, I've been caught up so much in my head, I really need to spend some time with loving people, etc. So first off, let's just acknowledge the innate wisdom that's already within us, which if we give it the space and time and quiet to inform us, will give us much of the information we need. Now, we can add to that by taking some time for practices which refine and sensitize that inner awareness and inner wisdom. And, good practices for that are some very simple meditations, mindfulness, which is a great practice for refining our inner sensitivity. Any of the awareness practices can be really good for that. And of course, it can be valuable to talk with good, wise friends and just reflect together on the question of balance and optimizing the various parts of our lives. And then there are also tools like journaling, just taking the time to put into words some of what we're feeling and wrestling with and the values that we're concerned maybe aren't being expressed. So those are some of the things that can help.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Randy.
Another question, and I just can't help but ask this because I think you're definitely the first, and I would imagine the last person that we're going to have on an awaken call who was ever a circus acrobat.
That sounds possible.
And I was wondering just, what that, first, what drew you into that realm? You held, you were a circus acrobat. You also held a world record for high diving. And it seemed that at a physical level, you were operating at this level of excellence and with the level of grace that, is rare. And it seems at one level not to connect with what you're doing now. But I wonder, do you see any connections, or what is the thread there for you?
That's an interesting question. I haven't thought of what the thread is. The story is that as a kid, I was physically totally inept. I was skinny. I was weak. I was had no coordination. I was nicknamed Feb, short for feeble. So I was hopeless at all sports in Australia. Sports were everything. And then in my early teens, I got on a trampoline and found that there was a sport I could do and that I loved acrobatics and trampolining. So I really overcompensated and dove very, very heavily into that, and that led into diving. So I found myself competing at fairly high levels in trampolining and diving, and you know, at that kind of adolescent age where the you're suffering from testosterone toxicity, you try to, you know, risk your life doing things. So I dove off a bridge. It was the highest dive done at that time and survived, which is important. And I, you know, it was a valuable thing for me to be able to do. I'm not sure, other than kind of the overachievement that had a lot of thread to my spiritual life, was kind of a different incarnation at that time. But it was for me, it was very rewarding, a lot of fun, and helpful, and certainly in developing some skills that I would never have had otherwise.
And I think it's just about the physicality and the kind of being, the awareness of the body that would need to be there in those kind of feats, and whether, how that, translates into a more embodied spiritual practice as well. And it kind of, for me, is a segue into your other, another important aspect of your work, which is the kind of 8 pillars of well-being that you've been researching and writing and now filming about. And if you could speak a little bit about that for our listeners, I think that would be wonderful too, because I know the movement piece of it is one of those, the exercise is one of those pillars.
Yeah, thanks, Bobby. Well, I think certainly one of the central themes of my life and work has been around, how can we live most fully? What's the best game to play in life? Well, what's the highest game one can play in life, and how can one do that? And part of that is certainly health and well-being. I work as a psychiatrist in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, and it's been just deeply distressing to me to see how, in large part because of the economic and insurance and elements which dictate so much of medicine these days, with insurance companies wanting to pay the least possible for treatment of mental illness, and with the hospitals and universities being very strapped for money, that the primary emphasis now is on drug treatment and just an overlooking of the psychological, the spiritual, the lifestyle elements. And so I just felt moved to try and pull together all the research on lifestyle and mental health, well-being. And it took me some years to do, but eventually I was able to pull together this literature and to demonstrate quite powerfully that lifestyle has an enormous impact on our mental health and well-being. For example, and that 8 kinds of lifestyle have a lot of research demonstrating their benefits for our psychological health and well-being. Things, a number of those we all know very well. Some, like exercise and a vegetarian or pesco-vegetarian fish and vegetable diet, enormously helpful for brains and mental health. Relationships, good quality relationships and community. Time in nature, for example. Service turns out to be enormously important for well-being. I mean, it turns out it's not just a nice idea, it's not just good for other people, it's enormously helpful to our psychological and even physical well-being. And spirituality, contemplative practices, and practices for cultivating relaxation and calm. These are just turn out, all of them, to be very powerful indeed.
And there's a documentary that will be coming out shortly?
Hopefully so. We have there's a website, 8waystowellbeing.com, and we're trying to get money to complete a documentary looking at bringing these to a PBS audience.
Wonderful. Well, we'll really look forward to that. We have another caller in the queue.
I notice I'm running low on juice in this. I'm going to put this on a speakerphone here. So if there's a noise, that'll be me transitioning.
No problem.
Oh, sorry about that.
And do we have our next caller on?
So could you say just a little more in closing about the workout, the challenge, and the benefits of applying everything you've talked about today in our closest relationships, like our marriages with our partners and with small circles of people where we live?
Okay, so how to apply this in our most intimate relationships.
It's just what do you experience as the value of doing that and the of applying it in your marriage, especially in your close relationships? Is that where you learn the most, or as much as from other sources of wisdom and insight?
Great point. Definitely, to the extent one can bring these practices and intentions to one's intimate relationships, they transform the relationships, and the relationships become vehicles for one's own and the other person's well-being and awakening. So it's really important. And just a couple of suggestions there. One is, it's really valuable if you can have an agreement, an explicit agreement with your partner, for example, or your small community, that our relationship is going to be not just about coming together and having a good time, though that's wonderful. It's also about our learning and growing and serving each other. So if that's explicit, then it just sets a whole different intention for the relationship and the community. And it gives you permission to be more authentic, more open, more honest, and to get helpful feedback. So that's a first thing. It can be really valuable to share a practice together, whatever it is, whether it's meditation or contribution, or for me and my wife, it's been particularly A Course in Miracles, whatever it is, but to share a practice can be very helpful. It can be very valuable to take time for together, just to be quiet together. It can be very valuable to have an emergency technique agreed on. That is, if you get into trouble, if there's say anger arising or fear, then whoever recognizes what's going on first has permission to say, let's have a timeout, let's stop. I'm feeling threatened, or I'm starting to feel angry, or I feel we're going off course. As per our agreement, let's stop, take a moment to become quiet, and to see what we really want to happen in this moment. So there are a lot of different practices that we could go further, but I think we're running out of time with our most intimate relationships. But this is a wonderful arena to deepen our work and to make our relationships richer and deeper and more valuable for everyone.
Wonderful. I feel like we could go on talking for hours, but as you pointed out, we are at the end of our call. We do have one last question to ask you, Roger, and this is something we ask all of our guests, and that is, how can we, as the Awaken and Extended Service-Based Community, how can we help further your work and vision in the world?
Oh, thank you very much. That's a beautiful question. Well, first, you can continue to do what you're doing, that is, serving and contributing. I would just ask that you deepen your own inner work and practice as much as you possibly can, as well as your service, knowing that anything you do to deepen your own insight, understanding, wisdom, will benefit us, benefit me, benefit us all. And if any of the books we've talked about feel helpful to you and you'd like to read those, that'd be wonderful, but there's no obligation. What's most important is to do what you're drawn to both deepen yourself and extend your contribution. And it will be wonderful for me to think of you all continuing to do that.
Thank you, Roger. And thank you for the privilege of having you on this call and for walking your path the way you have. It's rare to find someone with your depth of academic expertise, the research, you know, the profound research that you've done, and also the continuous practice that you bring into your daily life. It is powerful to have that lived wisdom speaking through you today.
Well, thank you. It's really been a privilege to be with you and your community.
Thank you. And just as you opened our call with a dedication, would you do us the honor of closing with a dedication before we close with a minute of silence?
Oh, Pavi, thank you very much for remembering that. Yes, I'd love to. So, what a gift we've had to be able to have this time together. So may all that we have learned and shared and explored and opened to together, may it serve the growth of all benevolent qualities within us, bring us the love and joy and compassion and wisdom that we aspire to, and make us ever more effective instruments of service for the welfare and awakening of all.
Thank you, Roger, Arye, and all our listeners. I will now be, as is customary, taking us all off of hold so that we can join together in a chorus of gratitude. One, two, three. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you,
Roger.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The
session is over.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.